the collar of his ruffled linen dress shirt, which is now darkened with perspiration. A cigar stub in the ashtray gives off a scorched smell. He is going over the books, head bowed. Running a circus is a huge enterprise that goes beyond the ring, or even the winter quarters. He is responsible for everyone's well-being, paying not just their wages, but the rent and food. I see then his weariness and age, and the heaviness of his burden. He looks up from the ledger in front of him, brow still furrowed.
"Yes?"
he says, his voice brisk but not unkind. "Am I interrupting?" I manage.
"No,"
he replies, but his voice is flat, eyes more sunken than a few hours ago.
"This awful business with Yetta falling. I have to file a report with the authorities."
"Will she be all right?" I ask, half afraid of the answer.
"I don't know," he says. "I will go to the hospital at first light. But first, the authorities have asked for a tax to be paid tomorrow. A sin tax, they call it."
As though what we did, providing entertainment, was wrong.
"I'm just figuring out where to draw the money from."
He smiles faintly.
"The cost of doing business. What can I do for you?"
I waver, not wanting to add to his problems. A small radio plays in the corner of Herr Neuhoff's carriage. They are contraband now, and I hadn't realized he had one. I noticed, too, a neat box of writing paper and envelopes on his desk. Herr Neuhoff follows my gaze.
"Do you want to write to your father and let him know you are well?"
I have considered it any number of times, wondering what my parents thought had become of me, whether they worried or had written me off completely. What would I say? That I have joined a circus and I have a baby now? So very much like the one taken from me? No. There is nothing about this life that they would understand. And if they knew where I am, part of me would always hope they would come for me, and I would be heartbroken all over again when they did not.
"I could write for you,"
he offers. I shake my head.
"Then how can I help?"
Before I can explain why I have come, Herr Neuhoff wheezes, his cough deeper and more barking than it had been in the winter quarters. He reaches for a glass of water. When the coughing subsides, he swallows a pill. "Are you all right, sir?" I hope the question is not too forward. He waves his hand as though swatting a fly.
"A family heart condition. I've always had it. The damp spring weather doesn't help. Now, you needed something?"
He pushes for my question, eager to return to the books. "It's about Estrid," I begin hesitantly. Taking a deep breath, I tell him about the German in the front row who knew her. His face darkens.
"I feared something like this might happen sooner or later," he says. "Thank you for letting me know."
I can tell from his tone I have been dismissed. I turn back, daring to interrupt him one more time. "Sir, one last thing. Estrid would be very angry if she knew I told you." I watch the conflict on his face, wanting to agree to keep my secret, but unable to promise without lying.
"I won't say I heard it from you."
The offer is little comfort. I'm the only one who knows. Worry tugs at my stomach as I walk from the train car. When I reach our carriage, Estrid sits on the berth in the darkness, holding Theo, who is sleeping. I fight the urge to poke him so he will open his dark eyes and look at me.
"He went down a few minutes ago,"
she says. Knowing that I just missed Theo being awake almost makes it worse. She strokes his cheek gently.
"I wanted to ask,"
Estrid begins. I freeze, trying to come up with a plausible excuse for where I had been. On your way back, did you see Peter? Not since we left the backyard. He was rehearsing, I say, mindful that it isn't quite the right word for fixing things after the show.
I wish I could go to him,
but he prefers to sleep alone on the road once the performances have begun. Her eyes drift longingly in the direction of Peter's train car. After seeing Eric's colleague, she dips her chin low to her chest.
I just don't want to be alone.
Her hands tremble against Theo's back. She is lonely, I realize. I had gotten used to being on my own during my months working at the train station at Bensheim. Having grown up an only child, it was not so difficult. But Astrid had gone from her large circus family to Eric, and then quickly found Peter. Despite her fierceness, she can't handle being alone. You aren't alone, I say, feeling a second-best substitute, inadequate. I wrap my arm around her. I'm here. She stiffens, and for a second, I wonder if she will pull away. Since coming to the circus, it has always been me needing Astrid, depending on her. Now the opposite seems true. Astrid stretches out on the berth with Theo in her arms. I slip in beside her, her body warm. We press our foreheads together like twins in the womb, one entity breathing together. I feel comfort in a way I hadn't since leaving home. Astrid had joked once that she was old enough to be my mother. But it is true. I see my own mother now, as clearly as I had the day she watched me leave. She should have fought for me, protected me with her life. Now, having Theo, I understand what her love should have been and was not. "What are you thinking?" Astrid asks. It is the first time she has taken an interest. About the sea, I lie, too embarrassed to admit that I yearn for the family that had cast me out. The sea, or the people who live near it? She asks, her tone even as she sees through my answer. Your family, you still love them, don't you? I suppose. The admission feels like a weakness. You cry out in the night for them, she says. Feeling myself flush, I am glad she cannot see my face through the darkness. I still dream about Eric, she confides. And I still have feelings for him. I am surprised. Even though he turned me out? Rejected me?
Yes, even then. You love the people they were before. Below all the awfulness that made them do this thing, you know?
I do. In the sadness of her voice, I can hear how very much it hurt when Eric turned his back on her. But now you have Peter, I remind, wanting to ease her pain. Yes, she acknowledges.
It isn't quite the same, though.
He cares for you a lot, I press. Beside me, I can feel her stiffen.
Peter enjoys my company. That is all.
But Astrid, I can see how much he cares for you, and you him. She does not answer. How can Astrid not see the truth about Peter's feelings? Maybe after all she has been through, she is afraid to want more.
Anyway, we were talking about you,
Astrid says, shifting the subject.
I know you miss your family, but the past is the past. Face front, shoulder to the wind. You have Theo now. You are never going back.
Her voice is firm.
You need to accept that if you are to save yourself and Theo. Unless, of course, you find his family.
You want him to find his family, don't you? She presses. A knife of pain shoots through me. Of course. It would be a relief, I reply, my voice hollow. Though I had thought of Theo's family, prayed for them, I cannot imagine ever letting go of him. He is mine now. Or if not, he could be adopted. He isn't yours. He belongs with a family. You are a young girl with your whole life before you. Someday you will have to let him go. I am his family, I think. I gesture around the rail car in the darkness. This is my life. I do not plan to stay with the circus forever. I need to get Theo farther away, out of Germany for good. But right now, it is hard to imagine anything else. One day you may feel differently, she replies. Sometimes our forever life does not last as long as we think. Her words seem to echo through the stillness of the sleeper. I bite my lip to keep from protesting. I had given up my child once, and it almost killed me. I could not survive that kind of pain again. Of course, Astrid does not know this. My past is still a hidden secret. It seems to grow now in the space between us, pushing us apart, and making every bit of our friendship a lie. Astrid, I begin. I need to tell her right now about how I had come to be at the station the night I found Theo, about the German soldier. This secret cannot continue festering between us. If it is about the act, we can discuss it in the morning, she says drowsily. It isn't that. Then what? She asks, lifting her head. I swallow, unable to speak. Thank you, Astrid says before I can respond. There is a vulnerability to her voice I have never heard before. That is, I don't think I've told you that I appreciate what you are doing. Without you, I couldn't possibly continue to perform. Strictly speaking, that isn't true. She could continue on the Spanish Web or another solo act. But her heart is with the Flying Trapeze, and my being here makes that possible. I want you to know that I am grateful, she adds, finding my hand beneath the blanket. A lump forms in my throat, blocking the words I had meant to say. I could push through it, insist on telling the truth. But she squeezes my hand, and there is a warmth between us that has never been there before. My will to tell her evaporates and blows away like dust. What were you going to say? Nothing. That is, it's about Peter. I cannot bear telling her the whole truth about my past now. But in my haste to avoid my secret, I blurt out another. He was drinking before the show. I cringe, unsure whether I should have said this. It is not my business. But some part of me feels that she should know. Astrid does not respond right away, and I feel her stiffen with concern beside me. Are you sure? She asks. He always acts strangely before a performance. Her voice is uneasy, not wanting to acknowledge a truth she already knows. I'm sure. I saw him coming from the beer tent. Oh. She does not sound surprised, only sad. I've tried so hard to stop him. Try harder, I want to say. How could a person as otherwise strong as Astrid not be able to stand up to him? I just feel so helpless, she declares, her voice cracking. I expect her to cry, but she simply shudders. I move closer, and she falls into my arms, Theo sandwiched between us so tightly I fear he might wake and fuss. So helpless, she repeats, and I know she is talking about not just Peter. Finally, her shaking subsides, and she huddles closer to me. The show is the same, she adds, growing drowsy. As long as we keep performing, everything will be fine. My mind reels back to my conversation with Herr Neuhoff. I recall his troubled look when I told him about the German recognizing Astrid. And I can't help but wonder if I have made a terrible mistake. Chapter 10 Noah. I'm going into town, I say to Astrid. I hold Theo on my lap, spoon-feeding him the last of his lunch. It is a banana, a rare find by one of the kitchen workers, that I had mashed together with a bit of milk. When Theo first tasted it, his eyes widened with surprise, and he gurgled at the unfamiliar richness, so different from the usual bland porridge. Good food for Theo is scarce, since I cannot register him for a ration card without raising questions. So I give him whatever I have for myself to eat that is suitable. I set down the bowl, hoping Astrid will not protest. It is almost noon on Sunday, 2 days since our first show, and we have already finished 4 hours of rehearsing. My shoulders ache fiercely, and an earthy smell rises from the dampness of my skin. I'm going to the hotel to wash, I add. Since there is no running water at the fairgrounds, the circus keeps 2 rooms at a small hotel, one for the men and one for the women, where we can go to bathe each week. Astrid reaches into her trunk and hands me a little cake of soap. Here, she says, and I take it from her gratefully. The soap that the circus had given us is little more than a scratchy pumice stone, but this bar is smooth and sweet-smelling. I made it from Sepp, she adds. I am continually amazed by Astrid's resourcefulness and the things she knows how to do from growing up on the road. Then her brow wrinkles. Be back in an hour. I want to fix your knee hang and work on the split before tomorrow's show. But it's Sunday, I protest. The one day we do not perform. In the backyard of the circus on Sundays, circus folk practice a bit, or play cards, or simply rest their weary bodies. The children run free playing tag or hoops, enjoying a day where no one corrals them back from the big top, or shushes them to be quiet. A day of rest, but not for me. Astrid has me rehearse as much as if it is any other day, with just a few hours off after lunch to feed Theo and spend time with him. Today, it seems, I am not even to have that. I know better than to argue the point. Even though I have managed my first few performances Friday and Saturday, there is still much work to be done. I have attempted only the straight pass. I swing to a great height, and she catches me by my arms as I fall. But the variations we might attempt are endless. Pirouettes and somersaults, the ankle-to-ankle catch. What I have learned is just a drop in the ocean of aerialist arts, miles from good enough. About that, I break off. I was thinking, if I twisted at the end of the second pass, you could catch me in reverse. It is the first time I have dared to offer a suggestion, and Astrid stares at me as though I have sprouted horns. Then she shrugs and waves her hand. That would never work. Why not? I press. I would be lined up for the return, and it would look better than just the straight pass. She purses her lips in annoyance, as though I am a child pushing for sweets after having been told no. You need to keep working on the fundamentals. Don't get ahead of yourself. I step back, stung. I may perform well enough for the show, but she will never consider me an equal. Anyway, you should get started if you want to make it into town and back, Astrid says, changing subjects. I'll watch Theo for you. You don't mind? I ask, looking longingly at Theo. Though I am desperate to bathe and feel clean again, I do not want to leave him. I see so little of him on show days. By the time the last performance is over, he is long since asleep. I hate to give up any of our precious Sunday afternoon together. How I'd love to bring him into town with me. He could use a proper bath, instead of the metal pail in which I pour water over him, causing him to either cry angrily or squeal with delight, depending on the temperature. But I can't bring him into town and risk the extra attention and questions. Not at all. Estrid walks over and takes Theo from me. There is something in the tender way she looks at him that speaks volumes about the child she never had. She has been a bit kinder to me as well in the 2 short days since the first show. She is still demanding of my performance, but it seems like she actually thinks I can perform and be one of them. And after we spoke the other night about Peter and the past, I almost feel that we are friends who can trust one another. Or at least we could be, if not for the secret I am still keeping from her about my own child and the German who fathered him. I should have told Astrid weeks ago. It might have eased the damage. But I had not. And the truth remains buried between us, festering. Now it is not just the secret itself, but the deception of having kept it from her for which she would hate me. If you go through the woods, along the edge of the stream, it's quicker into towns than the road, she offers. I tilt my head, trying to envision the route she has described. Other than coming here by the main road the day of the arrival, I haven't left the fairgrounds. The pass is just behind the big top, she continues, sensing my confusion. Why don't we walk with you for a bit, and I'll show you. I follow Astrid, who weaves through the narrow aisle between the berths with Theo. We pass a dancer tinting her hair auburn with a homemade dye. Another darns a hole in her practice leotard. By the door, a heavy-set woman with one of the sideshows changes without modesty, her large breasts indistinguishable from the folds of flesh beneath them. I avert my eyes. With so many women living in one place, there is very little privacy, just one of the many things about circus life I will never get used to. We step outside. Earlier, when we'd gone to practice, the sky above the big top had been painted in pinks and blues. But now a wreath of fog sits atop the chapiteau, like a cap drawn low across the brow. We cross the backyard of the circus, the open space where tent meets train car, and the circus people spend their time, away from the prying eyes of the audience. Undergarments flap shamelessly on a clothesline. Near the cookhouse, the steamy smell of boiled potatoes wafts out, signaling the menu for dinner. I hear the clanking of dishes, a half-dozen workers washing dishes from the noon meal. As we pass the big tent, the noises from inside are a familiar symphony, a clarinetist practicing, and the grunt of the strongman, mixed with the clanking of swords as 2 clowns engage in a mock duel. Through the gap in the curtain, the arena looks sad in the harsh light of day. The velvet seat cushions are frayed and stained. The once clean sawdust that covered the ground is now littered with candy wrappers and cigarette butts. A pool of yellow in the corner where a horse had urinated gives the air a sour smell. At the edge of the fairgrounds, beneath a just-blossoming cherry tree, sits Drina, exotic purple skirts splayed around her, large knuckles bending beneath jeweled rings as she shuffles a deck of cards. She joins the circus each year, Astrid told me, appearing at the first tour stop and staying until season's end, entertaining audiences on the midway before shows. In this strange world, where almost all are accepted, Drina is still an outsider. Not just because she is Roma, a gypsy. The circus has all kinds of races, but her act is a sort of trickery, it seems. Like magic. Not circus, Astrid said disdainfully. It is an expression I've heard often in the months since I joined them, used to describe performances that do not fit into the circus ideal. Drina waves me over. I hesitate, looking to Astrid. Can I? I ask. I'll only be a minute. She rolls her eyes and shrugs. I move closer, curious about the odd-looking deck of cards Drina spreads in front of her, purposefully in a formation. I don't have any money to pay you, I say. She reaches up and grabs my hand without asking, runs her coarse fingers over the lines on my palm. You were born under a lucky star, she says. Lucky. How many times had I heard that before? But you have known deep sorrow. I shift uncomfortably. How can she possibly tell? You will know peace, she adds. It seems rather a bold prediction for these times. But first, there will be illness. And a break. A break? Like a bone? I ask. And who is going to get sick? She shakes her head, saying no more. Suddenly uneasy, I stand. Thank you, I say hurriedly. I start back to Astrid, who is twirling in a circle with Theo to amuse him. What did she say? Astrid asks, curious in spite of herself. Nothing important, I reply self-consciously. I don't know why you believe in such things, she scoffs. And I don't know why you don't, I want to reply. But I fear it will sound rude. I like the promise of the unknown, of what might be out there. The future will be here soon enough, she replies. Farther from the circus grounds, we start into a forest and cut through the trees. They are denser than they had appeared from a distance, a forest of pine and chestnut. It is not so very different from the one I'd been struggling through the night I'd taken Theo. But the snow is gone, and tiny shoots of grass and weed poke out of the damp earth. Light slants through the branches, which are dotted with the earliest of green buds. Something rustles in the low brush. A fox, or perhaps a hedgehog. If the weather had been mild that night as now, I might not have collapsed and found my way to the circus at all. I thought I might also look for some extra food for Theo in town, I tell Astrid. Some rice cereal, or fresh milk. It's Sunday, Astrid points out. I nod. That's the catch. The one day that I can get away to town is the same day that most shops will be closed. Of course, there is always the black market. I'd heard of such things from the time our village was occupied, as well as at the girls' home and the train station. People selling goods illegally that one couldn't get elsewhere at a higher price. I wouldn't know where to begin finding that. My shoulders slump. Perhaps if I ask in town...
No! She replies sharply. You must not do anything to arouse suspicion. If you ask the wrong person, it could raise dangerous questions.
Soon the forest breaks to reveal a stream. Willow trees rise from its banks, then arch, not quite dipping low enough to break the glass-like surface of murky water.
There!
Astrid says, stopping and gesturing across the slight arc of a wooden footbridge that marks the edge of town. You aren't coming with me? I ask, disappointed. It would have been so much easier and more pleasant to go into town together. She shakes her head.
Best not to be seen.
I wonder if she is talking about herself, or Theo, or both. Is she thinking still of the German who had come to the show that first night? But her eyes still look longingly toward the village.
Anyway, someone has to mind Theo, she reminds me. You have your papers, yes?
Yes. I pat my pocket.
Be careful.
Her brow furrows as she studies my face.
Speak with no one, unless you absolutely must.
I'll be back in an hour, I say, kissing Theo on the head. He reaches out his tiny hand, as if to say, take me with you. More and more each day, it is as if a veil has been lifted, and he sees the world, understanding. A tiny piece of my heart seems to break off then and there, as I squeeze his fingers gently.
You should go now if you are going at all,
Astrid nudges. I kiss Theo once more, then start toward the base of the hill on which Tears is situated, and begin to climb the steep path that winds through the half-timber houses, with shutters the color of ash set close to the road. Partridges call out to one another from the eaves. The main street is quiet on a Sunday afternoon, with most of the shops closed. A few old women in shawls make their way toward the Romanesque church at the top of the town square. It is the oddest sort of normal. A cafe with well-coiffed women sipping coffee and nibbling madeleines behind round windows, men playing boules on a grassy patch by the town square. A boy of 10 or 11 sells newspapers at the corner. The hotel is no more than a large pension. Two tall adjoining houses that had been combined by knocking out the wall that had once divided them. I take the key from the proprietor, who seems to know without my saying why I have come. Had he been to one of the shows, or was there something about me now that marked me as circus? I make my way through the tiny lobby, packed thick with guests sitting in chairs and smoking as they lean against the walls. The circus had been lucky to get rooms at all. The hotel is filled with refugees who had fled from Paris at the start of the war, or villages farther north that had been destroyed by air raids or fighting. L'Exode, Astrid had called it. Whatever the reason, they had not gone back, but stayed for lack of a home or place. The second-floor room is narrow and plain, with a poorly made wrought-iron bed and drops of water from the last guest not quite wiped from the basin. I undress quickly, brushing away a bit of the ever-present sawdust from the ring that had somehow found its way beneath my skirt. I pause to study myself naked before the mirror. My body has begun to change from all of the exercise, as Astrid had predicted, hardening in some places and lengthening out in others. But it is more than just my physical shape that has been transformed from my time on the trapeze. Since we've been on the road, I find myself working harder, constantly thinking about the act. For hours after a performance, I feel the air rushing beneath my feet, like a train I cannot get off. I even dream about the trapeze. Sometimes I jerk awake, grasping for a bar that is not there. I am obsessed during my waking hours, too. I'd even crept into the arena in the darkness one night. Though the stands were empty, eyes seemed to follow me from all directions. Only a bit of moonlight peeked in. It was foolish to practice alone without anyone to spot or call for help if I fell. But the hours of training during the day simply were not enough. I told Astrid, hoping she would applaud my determination.
You might have been killed, she spat.
Whatever path I choose, it is always wrong. Too much or not enough. Still, the lure of the harder tricks calls me. If I can just add a pirouette, get a little higher to perhaps manage a somersault. I don't have to do it. I am keeping up my end of the bargain just by performing. But I find myself wanting more, reaching for it. A half hour later, I step from the hotel, freshly bathed. I eye the row of shops, tempted for a minute to wander and enjoy. Perhaps despite what Astrid said, there might be a store or two open to find some food. Theo will be waiting for me, though. I turn to go. Across the street, a young man of 18 or so, with coal-black hair, loiters in a doorway. He watches me in a way I'd almost forgotten that I had felt only one time before. My skin prickles. Once I might have been flattered, but I cannot afford to have anyone notice me now. Does he mean to make trouble? I lower my eyes and hurry past. At the corner, a man sells fruit on the back of an upturned crate. I see strawberries for the first time since the war. Mottled and too green to be ripe, but strawberries nonetheless. Desire floods my mouth. I imagine Theo's face as he tastes the unfamiliar sweetness for the first time. I fish in my coat pocket for a coin as I walk toward the crate. After I've paid the seller, I put the two strawberries I could afford into my pocket, fighting the urge to eat one now. Behind me, I hear a snicker. For a second, I wonder if it is the dark-haired man I'd just seen. Instead, I turn to find two boys, 12 or 13 years old, pointing in my direction. I glance around to see what they might be laughing at, and then realize that it's me. I look down at my sheer red skirt with patterned stockings and my low V-necked blouse. I no longer fit in with ordinary people. I raise my hands to cover my chest, my shame rising. On the trapeze, I've learned how to hide behind the lights and pretend it isn't me. But here, I feel naked and exposed. A woman walks up to the boys, their mother, perhaps, and I wait for her to scold them for their rudeness. Instead, she shoos them back, putting them behind her as if to shield them from me. "Keep your distance," she warns them in French, not bothering to lower her voice. She stares at me as though I might bite. Seeing us in the ring is one thing, an encounter on the street something different entirely.
"Pardon? That's quite enough," a voice says behind me.
I turn to find the man who had been watching me a minute earlier. He looks at me oddly, and I wait for him to take her side.
"The circus performers are our guests in the village," he says instead.
I wonder how he knows I'm from the circus, and then I realize it must be how I'm dressed. I take a step back.
"But look at her," the woman protests,
gesturing in my direction with disgust. I flush. Outsiders think of the circus as dark and sexual, Astrid had warned me once. In reality, it is the furthest thing from the truth. If anything, life on the road is more strictly run. There is a chaperone in the girls' tent, and a curfew earlier than the one the Germans had set. We are too tired to get up to trouble. Still, nosy fans stick their heads in the backyard, trying to get a glimpse of something exotic or untoward. In fact, our lives are boringly simple. Wake, eat, dress, practice, repeat. The woman opens her mouth to speak, but the young man interrupts before she can say a word.
"Au revoir, Madame Verrier,"
he says dismissively, and she turns and walks down the street with a huff. "Bonjour," he says to me when the woman has gone. Remembering Astrid's admonition about not mingling with the townsfolk, I turn to go.
"Wait,"
he calls. I look back over my shoulder.
"I'm sorry that woman was so rude. I'm Lucien," he continues, extending his hand.
He does not give his last name, as people did back home when introducing themselves, and I wonder if that is the custom here.
"They call me Luke, for short."
Closer now, he is taller than I realized. I barely come up to his shoulder. I hesitate, then shake his hand lightly.
"Enchanté,"
he says. Is he mocking me? There is no guile in his face, none of the leering of the other townsfolk. Noah, I say haltingly.
Like the Ark,
he remarks. I cock my head.
In the Bible.
Oh, yes, of course, I reply. From across the street, the boys snicker again, their mother having disappeared into one of the shops and out of earshot. Luke starts toward them, face thunderous. Don't, I say. You'll just make it worse. I'm leaving anyway.
That's too bad, he says. Can I walk you?
Without waiting for a response, he takes my arm. I jerk away. Excuse me, I say. Is it because I'm with the circus that he has the nerve to presume he can do that?
I'm sorry. I only meant to help you.
His tone is apologetic.
I should have asked.
He holds out his hand once more.
May I?
Why is he being so nice? He is friendly. Too friendly. No one is nice just for the sake of it these days, not unless he wants something. The German soldier appears in my mind. I don't think it's a good idea, I say.
A boy walking a girl? What is so wrong with that?
He asks. His eyes meet mine. A challenge. Fine. I relent, letting him take my arm. He starts walking once more, leading me toward the edge of town. His fingers are warm through my sleeve. He moves quickly, with self-assurance, the kind of boy whom I never would have dared speak to back home. We cross the footbridge, near the edge of the forest. I stop and pull away, more firmly this time. I can manage myself. Letting him walk me out of town is one thing. If he comes any farther with me, though, someone from the circus might see me mingling. As Astrid said, I should not. I can almost feel her eyes on me. I turn in the direction of the woods, wondering if she is watching. But I see no one. Still, I am not supposed to be here. It has been well more than an hour, and she will be waiting for me to practice, perhaps even worrying. I have to go, I say firmly. He brushes a lock of hair from his forehead, his face a mix of hurt and puzzlement.
I'm sorry to have bothered you, he says, and begins to walk away.
Wait, I call out. Lucien!
Luke,
he corrects, starting back toward me. Luke. I roll the name across my tongue. I need to buy some things. In my haste to get away from those awful boys and their mother, I had nearly forgotten about finding food for Theo.
What sort of things?
Luke asks. I see Astrid in my mind, hear her cautioning me not to ask. Milk. Some rice cereal. I falter, not wanting to reveal the truth about Theo. He eyes me evenly.
For yourself?
Yes. I meet his gaze, not wavering. He is a stranger, not to be trusted.
Or for the baby?
He asks. I freeze, panicked. How does he know about Theo?
I saw you holding him in the parade the day the circus arrived.
Goosebumps form on my skin. I hadn't realized he had noticed me. Our lives, even outside the ring, suddenly seem like a fishbowl. My little brother, I manage, praying that he will not suspect otherwise as Astrid had.
Don't you have ration cards?
He presses, seeming to accept my explanation. Yes, of course, I reply, but they're never enough. He looks back over his shoulder toward the town center.
The shops are closed on Sunday,
he says finally.
Perhaps if you come back during the week.
It's difficult with all of the performances, I reply carefully. I consider asking him about the black market, but do not dare.
What do you do with the circus anyway? Tame tigers?
Luke's tone is chiding. For a second, I want to tell him that I have been here only a few weeks and am not really part of the circus. But they are my people now. I lift my chin. Trapeze, actually. I am proud of how good I've become at my new craft, the work I've put in to become so. It is lost in translation to non-circus folk like Luke, who still looks simply amused. You haven't seen the show, have you? He shakes his head.
Maybe I should,
he says, then smiles.
But only if you'll meet me afterward. For a coffee,
he adds, to make sure I hadn't thought he was suggesting something improper.
I'm sure I'll have questions about the show.
What do you say? I falter. He seems nice enough, and in another time I might have said yes more easily. I'm sorry. I can't, I say. Disappointment flashes across his face, then vanishes again just as quickly.
I can walk you the rest of the way, he offers, in case you see those boys again, or their mother.
It isn't necessary, I reply. No good would come from encouraging him, and I do not want any of the circus folk to see me with him, especially Estrid. I start down the road before he can offer further, feeling him watch me as I go.
Chapter 11 Astrid. I watch Noah cross the footbridge. A wave of protectiveness swells in me. Her first time off the fairgrounds. Will she manage it, or will her nervousness cause her problems? For a minute, I want to go after her and remind her again to be careful and not speak to anyone, and a thousand other things. I'd like to go to town and wash properly myself, but after the German nearly recognized me the other night, I do not dare risk being seen. I look around warily. The place where I am standing near the edge of the woods is not so very far from town, and I don't want to run into anyone and answer questions about the child or myself. My mind reels back to the previous night's performance. As I peered into the tent, someone caught my eye. A man in uniform, SS pin glinting on his lapel. Roger von Albrecht. He had been a colleague of my husband's in Berlin, and had visited our apartment on Rochstrasse a few times. How was it, I wonder now, that of all the towns in Germany and France, Eric's colleague had come to see our circus at its very first performance, hundreds of miles from Berlin? Such misfortune hardly seems possible. Of course, he had not been such a close friend of Eric's, just an associate we encountered at holiday parties and such. Close enough, though, that he might have recognized me. We had thought, by traveling to France, we were moving farther from danger. But it looms here, just as real. I watch as Noah walks toward the town center, shoulders squared. She is nervous, I can tell, going into town for the first time all by herself. But she presses forward. She really is a good girl, you know, I say aloud to Theo, as I start back for the woods. I can almost feel him nod in agreement. She loves you very much. She. What will Theo call Noah when he is old enough to speak? Mama seems a betrayal of the woman who gave birth to him, and whose heart surely still breaks. But every child should have a chance to call someone his mother. I shift, and Theo nestles contentedly into my neck. I have never taken to children, but there is something wiser about him, an old soul. I lift him higher on my hip and begin to sing Do You Know How Many Stars, a merry children's tune that I have not thought of since my childhood.
Do you know how many little stars are in blue heaven's tent? Do you know how many clouds trail all over the world? The Lord God has counted them, so that none of them are missing, among this great, vast amount.
I look down at Theo. Has he heard the song before? I wonder about his parents, whether they might have sung it to him. Were they religious Jews, or perhaps not observant at all? I switched to Raisins and Almonds, a Yiddish lullaby, searching his face for some sign of recognition. He watches me with wide, unblinking eyes. It seems so improbable, a Jewish baby finding its way to the circus, and to me, another Jew. What were the odds of that happening? But we are not the only ones, I remind myself. I had been with the Circus Neuhof about a month when I realized I was not the only Jew. I had spotted an unfamiliar man across the dining hall on the side where the workers sat, a slight, quiet laborer with a trim graying beard and a limp who kept to himself. One of the girls said he was a handyman called Metz, good at fixing small things. And so I went to him with my watch, a treasured 16th birthday gift from my father that no longer ran. Metz's workshop was contained in a small shed at the edge of the winter quarters. I knocked, and he bade me enter. Inside, the air smelled of fresh wood and turpentine. Through a door at the rear, I could see a narrow bed and a wash basin. Small appliances and broken machine engines filled the shelves and covered the floor of the cramped space. Scattered among them were clocks of different sizes and makes, more than a dozen of them.
"I was a clockmaker in Prague before the war," Metz said.
I wondered how he had come to be here. But circus folk did not share much of their past. It was always best not to ask. I handed him the watch, and he examined it. As he opened a drawer to find tools, I saw it, a tarnished silver mezuzah. Keeping it could have cost him his life. "Is that yours?" I asked, in spite of myself. Metz wavered, perhaps no more knowing of my past than I of his. I assumed my Jewish background was not a well-kept secret among the circus folk, but he had come during the years I was gone, and perhaps had not heard. He lifted his chin slightly. "Yes." At first, I was alarmed. Did Herr Neuhof know about this other Jew? Of course he did. He was sheltering this man just like me. I should not have been surprised. I had assumed Herr Neuhof had taken me in only to help the show, and perhaps as a favor to an old family friend. His kind of courage was boundless, though, and he would not have turned away a person in need, whether a star performer or a simple laborer or a child such as Theo with no skills at all. It was not about the circus or family connections, but human decency. Herr Neuhof had not told us of one another, though, perhaps trying to protect us in anonymity. "Beautiful," I paused. "My father had one just like it." A silent kinship passed between us. But the mezuzah sat in plain sight at the front of the drawer, threatening his safety and mine.
Perhaps you should be more careful with that.
The clockmaker looked at me evenly.
We cannot change who we are. Sooner or later, we will all have to face ourselves.
A week later, he returned the watch to me, refusing to accept money for the work. We have not spoken again since that day. We reach the edge of the fairgrounds. I carry Theo, whose eyelids have begun to droop, across the backyard. It is a warm spring day, and those who can rehearse outside. The sword swallower practices an act where he seems to cut an assistant in two, and farther afield, one strong man attempts to run over another with a motorized bicycle. I cringe. The axe had grown grimmer since the end of the Great War. As though people needed to see near death in order to be thrilled. Mere entertainment was not enough anymore. My heart lifts as I glimpse Peter behind the big tent, rehearsing. I have seen so little of him since our arrival in Tears. We are too busy and too exhausted. Even on Sundays, like today, our time together is not what it should be. Watching him now, my longing grows. With Eric, it had always been straightforward, the way a man and a woman were supposed to be together. But Peter makes love with wild hands and lips where they have never been before, and where I least expect them. Peter is rehearsing the act I know too well, the one that mocks the Nazi's straight-leg goose-stepping. The very routine Herr Neuhoff ordered him not to perform. I had hoped, after the other night's show, when he had not done the routine, that he had given up on it. He is practicing those unmistakable moves right now, though, with more determination than ever. The circus has always had to tread lightly on politics. There was a story once about an Austrian circus that had met its demise by putting a pig in a pickle hob, a Prussian military helmet and uniform. But Peter seems more and more reckless these days, and his skit, while subtle, is pointed enough that no one would miss the fact it was ridiculing the Germans. Remembering, I shudder. I should have been more forceful, asked him to stop. This is not some game, poking at an animal with a stick. We have everything to lose. But watching him, my admiration grows. He is standing up to the Germans in his own way, and fighting. Not simply accepting what is happening and the restrictions that have been placed on us, leading to our own inevitable demise. Or is it just the liquor that is making him bold? His raised foot wobbles midair, and he sets it down hurriedly, so as not to fall. Peter has been drinking, something I can no longer ignore now that Noah had confirmed it. I am no stranger to alcohol. I had seen it among the performers in our own circus, and even with my mother when things got to be too much. Once with Peter, it had been benign, a few extra glasses of wine in the evenings. I had not minded. In fact, I welcomed the way it seemed to make him more open. In front of others, he spoke little. Astrid, he would say when we were alone, and I watched the drink take effect, dilating his pupils. He would really talk to me in those times, rambling tales of his boyhood in Russia before the Great War. For a moment, I could see inside a bit and actually know him. But it is different now. His drinking is getting worse. I can smell it on him in the mornings, and there is an unsteadiness about him in the arena. If no one noticed, it is only a matter of time before Herr Neuhoff does too. Dread seeps through my skin. Drinking before practice or a show could get even the greatest performer fired. The circus cannot afford accidents, and there will be no safe quarters.